Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Matt, here we are back in the studio for our bi-weekly, no, it won't be bi-weekly, fortnightly is probably the best
term. Is that the way you put it?
I think that's the way you put it. Fortnightly deep dive Bible study, as you like to call it, as we continue on Thrive Deeper. Welcome, listeners. Great to have you with us. Today, we are going to move into the book of Esther.
It's a great story.
Lots of interesting characters in this story and some very interesting things about the book of Esther.
Very interesting, yeah.
Just before we sort of move into particularly Esther, I just want to give a bit of an idea of where this sits in the narrative of things. You'll recall recently, as we've talked through particularly the book of Ezra, but also Zechariah just recently, we were talking about the Jews that had returned from Babylon and gone and been given permission by Cyrus to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and particularly the temple there. What's happening now is happening back in Babylon.
In Susa, which is
part of the Persian Empire. Of course, because now Babylon has been taken over by the Persians. And it's probably around 50-odd years into the return, after the return of that initial group to Jerusalem. So that kind of gives you a bit of a timeline. This isn't a story that's following on from that. This is a story, in a sense, that's kind of running parallel to some degree to that. And remember from those readings that the Jews who had returned started to build the temple in Jerusalem. They faced opposition from the surrounding peoples who didn't want them to rebuild the temple. They wrote back to the Persian king to say, we don't think this is a good idea. They searched the records. They wrote back to Xerxes, I think it would have been, and they searched the records and found that Cyrus had issued this decree and said, no, they need to be able to keep doing that. And you actually need to pay for them to do it. So that's a bit of context of what's happening in Jerusalem. Now we come back a little further into the story, and we're picking up probably around about, must be 486 BC, 486 BC. And we're back in the Persian royal city of Susa, which was sort of the capital of, I guess, the Persian Empire.
Yeah, that's right.
And the Persian Empire was massive. I mean, we would say today the world, really. I mean, it was the known world, apart from perhaps some small areas. It really went from India all the way across, you know, the Middle East, as we know.
Yeah, except for, of course, the Greek. They didn't quite annex all the area of Greece. And of course, they were then conquered by Alexander the Great, around a sort of century and a half later.
Yeah.
But this is, I think it's worth saying to Xerxes, in some translations, it has Ahasuerus, it's the same person. They're just different
and
names.
And it's commonly accepted by most experts, historians and the likes, that's the same person.
Yeah.
So Xerxes, Ahasuerus, you can, interchange those names. Now,
just to locate Xerxes.
Yes, good idea.
So some listeners might remember a film called 300, or certainly the story of the 300 Spartans that fought at Thermopylae. You know, that's a very famous story, the 300 Spartans that sort of held out against the Persian Empire. Of course, they were all killed in the end, but it's this ancient story of bravery, and it was captured in this sort of comic book film called 300, and back in, I don't know, in the 2000s or something. That's the Xerxes that we're talking about here.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting, interesting sort of historical link there.
Yeah. Just a bit of a flag. It's probably not a family movie. If you think, watch that on Friday night with the kids. It's probably not a family movie. A fair bit of violence in it, and to some degree there is in the book of Esther as we work through this. But interesting things to note, as I was saying, Esther is considered to be one of the historical books of the Bible. Now, that doesn't mean that the other books of the Bible aren't necessarily historical, but it's particularly focused on what God's doing in history as opposed to God and how he impacts history. It's what God's doing and what's happening in the world at the time. The other interesting thing about the book of Esther, correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, I think it's only Esther and the Song of Solomon's where God isn't really mentioned directly,
that's right,
explicitly in the book. But of course, as we read through this, we'll see God's fingerprints through everything. And let's remember that this is being written to a people where God was almost like, you didn't need to, it's a bit like us saying, oh, did the sun come up this morning? We just We know the sun came up. Mm. We don't even think twice about it. Yep. God was impermeated in their lives. So
yeah, not only is it implicit, the book is actually about the faithfulness of God.
Yeah.
I mean, that's actually what the book is about.
That's right.
You know, yeah. And the fact that it's not mentioned is actually a literary device, because it's kind of there are really clear hints. So you're sort of invited as a reader to
lean in a bit,
to lean in and to understand what's going on here.
Yeah.
This sort of literary device of being fairly understated is quite, in fact, in a lot of the historical books, you know, from Joshua right through to Kings, you sort of are meant to kind of read off the sort of covenant themes
and through it. Yeah,
and see, so it's, you know, they're not holding up placards saying this is the meaning of this and this links back to these covenant promises. It's the understated thing is a device that's meant to sort of draw you in and allow you to sort of recognize this. And that's very much the case with this book. You know, you get quite loud hints.
Yes.
In this book.
Yeah.
Yeah, to say the least.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think fair to say also, we don't know really who wrote the book, although probably, and we'll talk about this character a little later in the story as we get into it, I think most commentators would suggest that perhaps Mordecai is the most likely person to have written the book. I don't think it's important about who wrote the book, but in this instance. But I think the other thing that's really interesting is what happens here is still celebrated today in Jewish culture, in Israel, particularly the Purim ceremony, which celebrates what happened here.
Yeah, I was over in Israel during the Purim season, and everyone, the classic thing they do, it's like, it's a bit like their version of Halloween. I mean, it's probably not a good, it's got nothing to do with that.
Let's go Christmas.
No, in the sense that they all dress up.
Yeah.
They all go out in the streets.
And they give dress gifts up as well.
Yeah, though, and so, you know, it's really a big thing. It's a big festival, the Festival of Purim.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's interesting. So this story is one of the stories that is told and celebrated. I mean, the other one, the Feast of Hanukkah the sort of the Maccabean Revolt, the two things that are sort of that belong to this later period. Mm. And that, you know, they're stories of, in some ways, quite violent sort of military victories that, you know, that Jewish people had. And they, you know, they're obviously in the festivals are celebrating God's protection and faithfulness and, you know, but it's very much built into the cycle of celebration. And I think that, you know, the main thing here is that this scattered people, that God is faithful, and in Susa is as far, you know, I mean, it's way, way in the east. So it's much farther.
It's in than Iran now.
Yeah, that's right. Much farther than Babylon, you know. So, at the very far reaches of the empire, there's a you know, big Jewish community there in Susa, and God hasn't forgotten them.
No.
And this is important because it's important for the scattered people of God, you know, down through history, who have invariably been scattered around. And the Feast of Purim celebrates the fact that God is still faithful to his people, no matter where they are, you know. And of course, people have already come back, and these Jewish people haven't gone back to Jerusalem, but God is still faithful to
them. That's right, wherever they might be. Yeah. I think, you know, you mentioned the fact that, you know, a lot of these ceremonies or celebrations are to celebrate military victories. Let's remember in this time, that was how the world was changed. Yeah. It was all military. It was all combative. You know, it was just the way, you know, things weren't really negotiated. It was like, who's got the biggest hammer takes control. And that's what we've seen up until this point in time. So,
And there's, you know, I mean, when we get to the end of the book, you know, we'll say something about that. Cause I do think there's a way of thinking here that if it's not fed through the messianic lens, you know, the lens of Jesus and how Jesus makes a real key change to value, like fundamental values in terms of what this next season is about. I think in some ways this sort of this highlights the importance of Jesus. And I don't think you can ever say too much about the importance of Jesus and the difference that Christ makes.
So I guess the point is, the challenge is here for us is to try to read this in the context of Jesus hasn't come yet, and this is the state of the world, and we just need to understand it through that lens before we get to that.
So, I mean, some listeners are going to wondering what we're talking about.
Yeah,
anyway, because it gets this gets pretty violent towards the end. So, let's jump into the story.
Well, the last thing I do want to say just before we jump into the story, it's clear it would seem that there's a fair bit of anti-Semitism already happening around the place.
Yeah.
I think there are Jewish people that are in positions of some authority. Mordecai, I would suspect, given his proximity to the king, and we'll come to him soon, probably had a position of authority. We've got the issue happening back in Jerusalem where they're trying to rebuild the temple and people are complaining about the Jews doing this. And then Xerxes issues a command to allow them to do it. And in fact, you guys pay for it as well, which would have created even more tension.
Yeah,
so I think it's important to come into this understanding that everything just wasn't rosy. There was already a bit of racial and religious tension happening in the city.
And that's quite a consistent theme through Scripture, you know, this idea that God blesses his people and then they become the object of resentment and so there's this, absolutely. We see this cycle of anti-Semitism,
so
which
in.
I think, you know, I think has gone right through, through history.
Correct.
In the first chapter, we have this story set up.
Yep.
And that's really what it is. So Xerxes is holding a kind of public exposition, essentially. Mm. This is a big show-off fest for all the nobles and
it's about 4 years into his reign, I think, and he's had some great military conquests, and it's like, hey, it's party time, but it's a very long party.
It's 180 days.
And then there's a feast after that for 2 weeks or something.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah. So it's not 180 days of constant partying. Yep. It's an exhibition. It's a time where he's, showing off and, all of his wealth. And so he finishes by holding this 7-day banquet, sort of sumptuous garden party and display of really astonishing wealth.
Yep.
So this is important for this setup of the story, because this is a massive ego fest, right, for him. This is huge. Now, interestingly, Herodotus, who's really the sort of first ancient historian in a way, apart from, of course, the biblical writers, this famous Greek historian, he related an incident that occurred during Xerxes' retreat from Greece when the king left his tent in one of the abandoned camps. And the Greeks were absolutely astounded to find in his tent like gold and silver couches.
It was just pocket money for him, though.
Yeah, that's right. And they were wondering why this rich Persian king would want to conquer their Greek poverty.
That's right.
Why does it, why does this guy need more? Meanwhile, while that's happening, and quite sort of unusually, Queen Vashti, his wife, the queen, is giving a separate banquet for the women in the royal palace of the king. Now, I say this is unusual because is there some sort of problem? You know, is there a little bit of rebellion here? Or
was it just there were so many people they decided to do?
Maybe, but it is a little unusual.
Yeah.
It is not customary. Now, at one point, Xerxes, in a drunken state, sends his queen to sort of put her out on display before his mates. You know, it's this classic scenario, and he's just showing off right now. She has none of this.
Yeah.
She just outright refuses. Now, the problem with this is that with her, I mean, he's showing off his power, right?
Yeah.
And he summons officially, summon the queen. And then, you can imagine the official coming back and whispering in his ear, she's refusing to come. This is humiliating for this guy.
I think it's interesting because Herodotus, I think it was, or maybe even Josephus, I can't remember who it was, suggested that because the text spoke specifically just of the crown, it was possible that they wanted her to come back with wearing nothing except
possibly.
The crown.
That's right.
And that's why she wasn't having any part of that.
Well, maybe.
Who knows? We don't know.
So he's absolutely furious. He consults his lawyers and his wise men.
Yep.
And they reply.
It's his pride hurt here. That's
right.
Pride,
but know? They, you know, I mean, they reply that this is going to set a dangerous example to all the women in the land. And in verse 18, they say there will be no end of disrespect and discord, right? So you got to make a public sort of statement here. So Vashti is divorced. She's banished from the king by the law of the Medes and the Persians. And we're going to hear more about the law of the Medes and the Persians. So the principle is that once a law is made, it cannot be repealed, right?
Yeah.
Even by the king, in fact. If the king makes a law, he can't then change his mind.
That's right.
And repeal it. So by the law of the Medes and the Persians, she's divorced. So, but the king needs a queen. Officially, I mean, he's probably already got a massive harem, but he still needs a queen.
Yep.
Every king needs one in those days. So the king's officials organise this elaborate sort of process. Beauty pageant,
yeah.
Queen search, this bizarre process. Because this has to be someone that the king can show off, right? This is the trophy wife that he's looking for. It's all very dysfunctional, by the way.
Before you move on there, I think another important thing is to note, and we'll see this pattern, the king seldom makes his own decisions. He constantly abdicates his decisions to someone else. What do you think? Okay, go and do that then. In fact, here's the checkbook in a sense. Go take care of it. Interesting to me that
it's that's an interesting point. And you do see that throughout. There's almost like this sort of constant abdication of responsibility. Anyway, so it's at this point that we're introduced to Mordecai the Jew, who went into exile with Jehoiachin and Ezekiel. So in 597, they all went, Jehoiachin the king, Ezekiel, and this guy, Mordecai. As you said, he probably is a man of influence already at this time. And he has this beautiful young orphaned cousin who he's really adopted as a daughter, really. Her name is Hadassah, but the Persian version of this is Esther.
Yeah.
Now, Esther, the name Esther is a version of Ishtar, goddess Ishtar.
And this was common that they used because they'd been in exile now for multiple generations, at least two generations. They were starting to use, they had two names, original Hebrew Jewish name and then their,
So she's taken, I have to say.
Yeah.
There's no option to this. She's taken to the harem. This is almost a kind of sort of, you get hints of sort of Israel in slavery in Egypt. It's that kind of thing here. But she's shown enormous favor. You know, she becomes the favored one in this sense. And this is actually repeated twice.
Yeah. And no one knows she's Jewish at this point in time. I mean, obviously Mordecai does, but they keep that secret.
Yep. So she's given the best of everything.
Yep.
But she's actually, she hides her ethnicity at Mordecai's instruction, which is, I think, indicative of the fact there is probably a lot of anti-Semitism at this point. So this is something that you need to sort of hide for self-preservation's sake. Mordecai obviously frets over Esther, and he's hanging out, outside the harem in the area outside the palace. And
we could have been coming there every day. That was where he did his business.
Yeah. Although I think the text seems to indicate that he's sort of
a bit
very concerned about it,
and particularly given she was taken, as you say, she probably didn't have any option.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So anyway, after 12 months, Stu, 12 months of beauty treatments, this is crazy, right? Each of the women, they would go into the king, and they would only be taken back if the king was pleased. And we won't go into the details of that. But anyway, Esther, we're told, wins everyone's favor, including that of the king. Look, she wins. Like, she wins this contest, whether that's a good thing. I mean, but in the context of the time and the text, this is seen to be a good thing.
Yes.
Because she's, as we'll see later on, she's in the, as Mordecai points out, it's for such a time as this that you have been put in this
position.
What's
the option? If she's not chosen, she's just going to be stuck there anyway.
Yeah, that's
right. With no influence whatsoever.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of nobody essentially in the harem of the king. So she's made queen. This is a huge position, a moment of elevation for a Jewess. But of course, the king doesn't know that she's, he still doesn't know that she's Jewish, because remember, she has a Persian name. So during this time, while Mordecai is outside the king's gate, so remember, he's fretting over Esther, he overhears two officers plot to assassinate the king. And he tells Esther, who tells the king, and these officials are, they're impaled. I mean, this is Persia. And these things are recorded. So it's a very quite short section. So because he's hanging in around the palace, he overhears this conversation.
Yeah.
They're going to assassinate the king. He reports this. They're dealt with. And this is sort of left, right? This is, in a sense, forgotten, but it is recorded in the official
records. And I
think
he was probably a little bit strategic in telling Esther, because he could have gone just to the authorities and told her, but he tells Esther because, again, he perhaps recognises there's an opportunity to help her.
Yeah, that's right.
Be safe, whatever it might be.
Yeah, that's right.
Influence.
Okay, so then in chapter 3, And it's, I mean, it's really, this story follows a really classic story arc, you know. So you've got this intriguing sort of section that's left, and then we're introduced to the arch villain, Stu.
Yes.
Of the story.
Haman.
That's right, Haman. And we're told, and so we're told that Haman is given the highest seat of honor under the king in the empire.
We don't really know why.
No, we don't.
Yeah. I wonder whether he was one of the guys that kind of also reported to the king with, you know, Esther around the whole assassination thing, but they kept the Mordecai thing on the lowdown. I don't know, but it's like, it's interesting that you hear he's, you know, basically 2IC over the biggest empire in the world, and we really don't know where
and
he
look,
came
he's,
from.
He's a very, what we learn about Haman is he's very wealthy.
Yes.
And probably very influential and probably the sort of guy that the king would want to keep.
Yeah, right. On his side.
Yeah, on his side in favor.
Yep.
Because, of course, kings in the ancient world still needed to do that. They still needed to, you know, keep
well, so many assassinations. If there's someone super powerful and strong, you want to keep them on
your
team.
You know, keep your enemies
close.
Yeah, close. Now, so everyone is told to bow down to him.
And it's not necessarily a worship. It's not a Daniel type bow down necessarily.
No, yeah. No, that's right. Yeah. Now, this is the important, very important part of the story, and it's easy to miss this if you're just reading through this story. This is where one of these clues, we get one of these very loud clues, right? Mm. We're told that he is an Agagite, a descendant, in other words, of Agag. Agag is the king of the Amalekites.
Yes.
Was the king of the Amalekites. So this goes back, Stu, to a story from the time of Saul. This is the hint, right? Mm. And if you miss this, you're going to miss a very important theme, an indicator about what this story is about, right? Yeah. So you will recall that Saul fights against the Amalekites. The Amalekites are these sort of traditional enemies. They go back to when Israel came out of Egypt. The first group of people to attack them in their weary sort of state were the Amalekites. Very famous story about Moses up in the hill and holding up his hands.
Right.
That story is the story of them fighting against the Amalekites. And there's other instances where the Amalekites sort of come against them. So these guys become their sort of traditional. There's a sort of curse on the Amalekites because of this. They also go back to tell us about how far this goes back.
Yeah, so Haman's in the lineage of Esau's family. So Amalek, who was one of Esau's sons, and obviously the forefather of the Amalekites. So he traces all the way back to there. And of course, Mordecai was a son of the Kish family from Saul's line. So you've got this, you know, this ancient rivalry way back then, now potentially beginning to play out.
Yeah. That's very important. So the connection, of course, in the story of Saul and the king Agag, the king of the Amalekites, they take the plunder. This is important as well for later on in this story. So the Amalekites have this law of harem, which is they are devoted to destruction. And which means that when they go to war against them, they're meant to be completely, you're not meant to take any plunder, right? Because it's completely, and the king is meant to be killed. Now, when Saul comes back from this campaign, you know, they've got all this plunder with them, and the Agag, the king of the Amalekites, is still alive, right? And so that Saul is making this mistake, right? Mm. That he's not following this rule of harem. Mm. Now, remember, Mordecai is a descendant of Saul, and Haman is a descendant of this Agag. Yep. And so that's a very important connection for this story. And of course, you know, Samuel rebukes. That's the moment where Samuel says, look, you've refused to follow God's instructions, and so you're removed as king. Mm. Now, remember, this period is a period of reinstatement for the Jews.
Yes. Which is getting resistance, as we said earlier. There's a lot of anti-Semitism because of that. Yep. So all the tensions are heightened at this particular moment.
Yeah, that's
moment.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so
here's Haman. Yep.
Yeah, that's right. So this is Haman. So what we learn is that everyone's bowing down to Haman, but Mordecai, for some reason, isn't bowing down. He persistently refuses, despite remonstrations from the royal officials. It's not exactly clear why, Stu.
Maybe he knows he's an Amalekite.
Yeah. I think it's most probably to do with that, because it certainly, you get the sense from the text that it has something to do with his Jewishness. Mm. And because this theme of him being an Amalekite is very important to the text, probably that's the key thing here.
Yeah.
you know, Haman's furious about. I mean, this infuriates him.
Because, again, it's about pride.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Everyone's seen this guy not bow down in front of him.
Yeah, so he's furious. But then, he finds out he's a Jew and he is going, there's already anti-Semitism. But when he finds out that this man that's refusing to bow down to him, and if it's for those reasons, if it is to do with his Jewishness and just because he's an Amalekite, well, he's thinking, so all of these Jews throughout the empire
Are now going to follow suit,
right?
A bit like the king earlier around Queen Vashti.
Yeah, that's right.
Same thing.
Same sort of scenario. So he determines that he's going to enact what really, and this is, I mean, the extent of this cannot be really overstated.
Yeah.
He is going to enact genocide throughout the Persian Empire, which is
huge
everywhere, pretty much,
yeah,
including Egypt. I mean, they've annexed Egypt and pretty much everywhere where the Jews are.
Yeah.
There's this edict. He's going to determine to wipe them all out. So in chapter 3, we learn that a lot, and the Babylonian word for lot is pur.
Yes.
This is where we're going to get the Purim, the word Purim from. So the Purim, or the lots, are cast to determine the date of this genocide. And this becomes the date of the festival of Purim, the date when the lot falls upon is this date, which is kind of late February, early March, normally around that period. So Haman seeks permission from the king to do this, and he argues that it's in the king's best interest. Mm. And he also, he provides a very large bribe as well, which, well, he seems to be rich enough to provide, but no doubt he's going to get a lot of this from the Jews. Yeah. It's going to be the plunder.
Yeah.
Now, note, Stu, what...
And again, the king doesn't make his own decision.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me, off you go kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right.
It seems like the king just wants to completely disconnect from his responsibility, and he likes the idea of being in charge, but wants everyone else to make the calls.
Stu, have a look what in chapter 3, verse 8, is a very important comment made here, with the comment that Haman makes about the Jews in 3, verse 8.
Sorry. Then Haman informed King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, this is one ethnic group scattered throughout the peoples in every province of your kingdom, keeping themselves separate. Their laws are different from everyone else's, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them.
See, that's important because it actually shows that these Jewish people at this time were not assimilating. Now, remember the whole purpose of exile was to make a people group disappear.
Yes.
By becoming assimilated, by losing their national and their religious identity and assimilating. Now, the Jews weren't assimilating. Mm. And this is one of the things that causes this anti-Semitism, right? Because they follow their own customs. And so there's a sort of perpetual xenophobia. They're not integrating into the culture. And
that's a similar reason given, if you recall back when we were, for the people who were in Jerusalem trying to read, when the letter was written to the king, it was a similar reason. These people are separating themselves. They've got their own laws. They don't obey the king.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a dangerous thing to let them rebuild the temple. So a very similar sense of
separation here. So anyway, the king takes the signet ring from his finger and he gives it to him. I mean, man, this guy is...
the signature to the checkbook.
Yeah, exactly. So he just lets him do with the people as you please, he says. So the royal decree signed, sealed and delivered to all the provinces with the order to, and I quote, to destroy, kill and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. Mm. So this is a moment that triggers to, and this is important because you've got some triggers here. First of all, there's the Amalekite thing.
Yes.
Then there's the family that Mordecai's from. So you think, oh, there's a connection here. Something's going to be played out here. Then you've got this decree that is a fundamental threat to all of the Jewish people.
Right.
This pulls the trigger essentially on the covenant promise. Genesis chapter 12, verse 3, those who curse you, I will curse, which is often expressed, for example, in the Psalms, those who dug a pit for me will fall into it themselves. They spread a net for me, but they will fall into it, they'll be caught up in it. The sword that they intended for, they have been slain by the sword that, was meant for me. All of these sorts of, ways of expressing that that sort of reflexive curse. You know, it's a curse that bounces, right?
Yes.
This whole story is essentially about that. You know, it's this sense that there's this curse that's put out on the Jewish people throughout the world.
Yes.
And it's a existential, not just a threat, but it's going to wipe them all out. So the question is, all right, so what is God going to do about fulfilling his covenant promises? And what you see in the story is that God has already acted.
Yes.
There's already something put in place. Like, and this is the important thing about this story, is that this doesn't take God by surprise.
No.
Now, of course, this isn't stated in the story, but you see clearly, and this is made explicit in a moment,
well,
in
even,
chapter 4.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even with the casting of the lots, if you think about it, it could have been the next month.
Yeah, that's right.
But
yeah.
It was 11 months. It was nearly a whole year.
Yeah, that's
had,
right.
Yeah, because the lots were casted aside when this was going to happen. And
yeah,
it came out
great
at 11
point.
Months,
yeah.
You know.
And so there's plenty of time for preparation here. You know, God is determining the lots. He's already put Esther in place. So all of that stuff around Vashti. And you think, wow, like God has been ordering events for the benefit of his people here. And so this doesn't take God by surprise. This is a very important message, you know, in this that comes through this book. So it says, it's interesting in chapter 3:15, you know, the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. So this is even in a fairly anti-Semitic context. This is, people are pretty bewildered by this, you know.
Yes, yeah.
Just coincidentally, I mean, it's like the sort of cross-reference to Esther, you know, chapter 3:15 is Genesis chapter 3:15. And of course, the verse orders and not original, but the promise of God that the seed of the serpent will strike the heel, but the seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent. And again, this is another promise that is fulfilled here. This is the serpent striking at the heel, but the serpent's head is going to be crushed here. So anyway, in Esther 4:1, it says, have you got that there?
Yeah,
Steve?
I have. Yeah, I'll read that.
Just
for
read
you.
Verse 1.
When Mordecai learned all that had occurred, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, went into the middle of the city, and cried loudly and bitterly.
Okay. So this is not just mourning. This is also a symbol of prayer, right? This is, and of course, everything is infused with prayer. So this is an official way of mourning before God.
But also remember, for Mordecai, he's feeling, oh my goodness, I'm responsible for now, the extermination of my entire people, because I wouldn't bow down to this guy. So there's probably a sense of him feeling the weight of that personal responsibility on a decision he made.
That's right.
Yeah.
So this is prayer, really. Yep. And actually all the Jews throughout the empire do the same.
Yes.
You know, this is their response to this. So there's prayer here. So again, one anticipates, wow, okay, there's this existential threat. This triggers the promise, you know, Genesis 3:15, Genesis 12, verse 3, you know, those who curse you will curse. Yep. What is God going to do? You know, so you've got this mounting kind of question here. Now, Esther hears about Mordecai and she sends her attendant to find out what is. It's interesting, isn't it, that she doesn't know?
She doesn't know. Well, of course, because at this stage, no one knows she's Jewish still. They think that no one's going to tell her because it's irrelevant to her.
That's right.
You know,
Yeah, I mean, but you'd think this is a big thing, but somehow in the palace, it's all sort of sealed off.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't have the internet in those days, mate.
I mean, it's interesting. She tries to offer clothes and he won't, you know. So, you know, Mordecai tells her about the decree. And then Esther 4:8, I think, Stu, is important too. Have you got that there?
Yeah. So Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa ordering their destruction so that Hatak might show it to Esther, explain it to her, and command her to approach the king, implore his favor, and plead with him personally for her people.
Yeah, that's right. Now she says,
I can't
go before the king.
Yeah.
You know, the rule is, well, the law of the Medes and the Persians is that if you go unsummoned before if you just burst in before the king, you die. Unless, of course, the king holds out his royal scepter. Mm. So there's a very important answer that he gives here. You know, he basically says, look, I think actually this is worth reading, Stu.
Do you want to start from verse 10? Esther spoke to Hatak and commanded him to tell Mordecai, all the royal officials and the people of the royal provinces know that one law applies to every man or woman who approaches the king in the inner courtyard and who has not been summoned, the death penalty. Unless the king extends the gold scepter, allowing that person to live, I have not been summoned to appear before the king for the last 30 days. Esther's response was reported back to Mordecai. Mordecai told the messenger to reply to Esther.
Yeah, this is important, his reply.
Yeah. Don't think that you will escape the fate of all the Jews because you are in the king's palace. If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come to the Jewish people from another place.
Right, that's a very, very veiled.
But you and your father's family will be destroyed. Who knows, perhaps you have come to your royal position for such a time as this.
That's right. So another place, it's this sort of veiled literary allusion to hint, you know, God, in other words, he's saying, listen, God is going to be faithful to his covenant, but it seems that God already has.
Yes, and you're it.
And you're it, right? So that's your assurance. Like, you are there for this reason.
Yeah.
So do this with this sense of trust. So anyway, she...
She then gets the Jews to go and pray and to fast as well.
Yeah, that's right. You know, yeah.
Everyone
pray for me. Yeah, for 3 days. So they all do that. Again, you know, this prayer is important again, you know, because this is how it works. There's prayer and then there's God's faithfulness. Mm. So she goes and, of course, she's granted grace. You know,
yes.
He holds out the scepter. Then it says in Esther 5:3, you know, the king asked, what is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you.
Which he's not really offering that. He's essentially saying, hey, whatever you want, it's yours. But he's not really saying that. Is
but
he?
This
I don't
is,
think he is.
Well, yeah, probably not. I think it's just a way of saying something. Because, I mean, it's interesting that King Herod says, one of the Herods says the same when Salome dances before. He says, I'll give you anything up to half my kingdom.
Wow.
And she says, I want the head of John the Baptist.
Yes.
So
yes.
Similar statement is made there. So... You expect Stu.
Esther would jump
that she'll
in.
Say, that she's going to say, like, he said, up to half my kingdom.
I'll take the Jewish half.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Can I? But and this is where you get this mounting tension because she doesn't do this. Now, this is actually really clever. This is very shrewd because it's not just about saving the people. There's also the issue of Haman, right? Because it's going to continue to be, with him in charge, this is going to continue to be a threat. So she's actually doing something really shrewd here. So rather than...
Well, I think she also knows the king's not that smart, clearly.
That's right.
So she's going, I can't really rely
on him. Very powerful, but not that smart.
Yeah.
So she doesn't bring up the main issue. No, she has clearly a more complex plan. She requests that the king and Haman
come
to a banquet.
Yeah.
They come... And
she creates an imperative by saying tomorrow.
Yeah.
So it's like, you can't think about it. It's tomorrow. And in fact, if you're going to have a banquet tomorrow, you've already started preparing for the banquet. So
that's right.
It would be pretty rude to say, well, we're not coming.
So they have the banquet. Then the king says, okay, so now what
he
is
he knows the there's an agenda here, doesn't
he? Yeah. And then she says, could you both come to another banquet now?
It's like she's just getting cold feet or something.
Well, the interesting thing about this Haman is... Absolutely delighted. I mean, this for Haman, he has been invited into their lounge room, right? The royal lounge room.
And he doesn't know she's Jewish, though, remember?
Yeah, he doesn't know. So his ego is just really inflated now. And the one thing about an inflated ego, it's very tender, right? Mm. The more inflated it gets, the more, like a big balloon, it becomes more tender. And so he goes and he boasts about this.
To his
family and friends. Look, I've been invited to this. But his inflated ego now just cannot bear Mordecai's insult.
He obviously walks past Mordecai on his way home to do the bragging thing, and he sees this guy still not bowing down.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I mean, Mordecai's not relenting from this.
No, that's right.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, look, it's too late anyway. There's nothing you can do, really.
He's not,
The decrees. So he's thinking, oh, well, it's, you know.
And I think the fact that he was invited to the banquet has emboldened Haman to kind of deal with this issue.
Yes, exactly. That's right. So his wife and his friends, after, you know, hearing all his complaints about Mordecai, you know, advise him to set up this gallows, which really, you know, it's this massive, how high is this? Something like 30 feet or something.
Yeah.
This massive.
50 feet, I think it is.
You know, which is it's like this massive pole upon which he's going to be impaled. We'll leave that to listeners' imagination.
But then an interesting thing happens. And so he gets that set up ready to go because he thinks the next day I'm going to get rid of this guy.
Yes. Yeah.
But then I can go and enjoy the banquet with the
queen. Yeah, that's right. So he sets up the gallows. It's all ready to go.
Let's get that
done. He's going to go and make this request of the king.
Yep. Get that done.
The idea is that next day, I'm going to impale Mordecai.
Yeah, and then I can enjoy the second banquet with the queen. But for some reason, the king didn't sleep that night.
That's right.
And again, here's God's hand.
Yeah, we would say in here. Yeah, that's right. So this is exactly. This is another clue here. So he orders that the court records be brought in and read to him. I mean, I'm sure they're boring enough to put him to sleep.
It's like a meeting or something. That's right. Is that what he wants to read for?
Anyway, but he doesn't fall back asleep. In fact, they come across this record of Mordecai's uncovering this assassination plot. And this, I think, Stu, it's worth reading a block of text here, actually. And I think probably from 6 verse 3, because this is a crucial moment.
In
the text.
I'll read that.
And I'd go right down to, it's not long, down to 7 verse 6.
Yeah. The king inquired, "What honor and special recognition have we given to Mordecai for this act?" The act being that he reported Esther. And Esther had obviously told the king that it was Mordecai, so they knew it was Mordecai. The king's personal attendants replied, "Nothing has been done for him." The king asked, "Well, who was in the court?" Now, we know what that really means, but it could be that someone had just walked in and it's a, hang on, who's that just walking in? Yeah. Now, Haman was just entering the outer court of the palace to ask the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows he had prepared for him. The king's attendants answered him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." "Have him enter," the king ordered. Haman entered and the king asked him, "What should be done for the man the king wants to honor?" Now, of course, you can imagine Haman's balloon-shaped ego now. He's going, "Whoa.
Oh, wow, this is me.
I better think about this carefully because this is, Haman thought to himself, "Who is it the king would want to honor more than me?" Haman told the king, so of course Haman is now shaping the honor around what he would like.
Yeah, so he thinks this is for him, so he's going to really go for broke.
And he's rich,
so
he's not going to go for money or anything like that. He's already incredibly wealthy.
Yes.
"For the man the king wants to honor, have them bring a royal garment that the king himself has worn and a horse the king himself has ridden, which has a real crown on its head. Put the garment and the horse under the charge of one of the king's most noble officials. Have them clothe the man the king wants to honor, parade him on the horse through the city square, and call out before him, 'This is what is done for the man the king wants to honor.'" The king told Haman, "Hurry, do just as you proposed." Again, you know, the king doesn't come up with anything himself. Yeah. "Take a garment and a horse for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not leave out anything you have suggested." You can kind of imagine Haman's balloon right now just popped.
It's the very guy that he is being humiliated by, right, is now the one that he's got to parade around.
And he's got to do it.
He's got to lead the horse. So he's essentially like the sort of slave boy, you know, leading the – oh, this is just a classic moment.
So Haman took the garment and the horse. He clothed Mordecai and paraded him through the city square, calling out before him, "This is what is done for the man the king wants to honor." Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried off home, mournful and with his head covered. So covering your head was a sense of shame, really. Haman told his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends everything that had happened. His advisors and his wife, Zeresh, said to him, "Since Mordecai is Jewish and you have begun to fall before him, you won't overcome him because your downfall is certain." Be good for you to speak to that in a minute, Matt.
Yeah.
While they were still speaking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and rushed Haman to the banquet Esther had prepared. So probably Haman had lost track of time. Yeah. He was meant to be at this banquet. All of this had happened. He was at home weeping over his own broken ego, and he's forgotten he's meant to be at a banquet.
Yeah.
But this line, "Since Mordecai is Jewish and you have begun to fall before him, you won't overcome him because your downfall is certain."
Yeah, I mean, this sort of has this double meaning because to Jewish readers,
they would know what that means.
They're almost prophesying this promise, you know, that it's triggered this, you know, Genesis 12 verse 3, "Those who curse you all will curse." So he's done for, in this sense. So they probably didn't mean it obviously like that because they're not perhaps aware of that, but it's certainly for the reader, I think, is going to see it like that. So then
he's off to the banquet.
And this, in a sense, this is the climax of the story. And I might just read from here a little, Stu. And I'm reading from the NIV here. So what version were you reading from
CSB.
CSB, Christian Standard Bible. NIV Chapter 7. So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet. So he's in a sort of a state really here. Mm-hmm. As they were drinking wine on the second day, the king asked, we have this moment. Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted.
It's the third time he's had to
That's
ask
right.
that question.
Then Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. See, remember, he doesn't yet know that she's a Jewish person. And spare my people, this is my request, for I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is he? Where is he? The man who has dared to do such a thing. Esther said, an adversary, an enemy, this vile Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the queen. So the king gets up from here in an absolute rage. I mean, he is so furious.
And Haman's day, where he thought it couldn't get any worse, just got a whole
lot
worse.
It just got a whole lot worse.
He now knows that Esther is Jewish.
Yeah, that's
right. The first time he would have joined those two.
Oh, yeah. So it's just a cinematic moment, and it really is the climactic moment. So both the king and Haman have found out in their own, that she's Jewish. The king storms out. Haman is desperate now, right? He's because he's really in trouble. So he falls down at the feet of the queen. And when the king comes back, he's almost like groping her in his desperation. I mean, he's completely lost his mind at this stage, right? Yeah. And so he's sort of tugging on her skirts and begging, and the king comes in and
he's already
what
angry.
Are you molesting
my wife now?
Yeah. Now on top of everything, you are molesting the queen. Then one of the servant helpfully pipes up and says, "King, actually, there's a." As you say, yet again, the king isn't making the decisions. One of the courtiers says, oh, look out there. There's a, 30, 40, whatever foot high pole that's been put up.
Yeah.
And this was meant for Mordecai.
Yeah.
How about you have Haman impaled on that pole?
Yeah.
And of course,
that's the first time the king would have heard that Haman was going to try to kill Mordecai.
Yeah, that's right.
Because, as far as we can tell, there's been no disclosure of that. So it's like, here's the gallows pole that Haman had intended previous day to ask the king to.
And that's important because, again, you get this theme of reflexive curse, right?
Yeah.
That that they have been killed with the sword that they were in, that was meant for me, or they've fallen into the pit that they dug for me. These sorts of expressions abound in scripture. And this is exactly what happens here. So that's like this great story climax there. And then you have in the last three chapters, you have this sort of outcome.
Yeah.
Because, of course, remember, one of the problems here, Stu, is that this decree is still
which can't be
active.
Undone. You can't just cancel that.
Yeah.
The laws of the Medes and the Persians.
Anyway, but look, we find it, so Esther actually receives Haman's estate and, significantly, Mordecai is – Mordecai's given his position.
His role.
So this is yet another example of a Jewish person. So remember, Joseph becomes the prime minister of Egypt under Pharaoh. Mm. You've got Daniel, essentially, has the the highest position under Nebuchadnezzar.
Mm.
And now you've got
Mordecai.
This is easy to forget this because we know a lot about Daniel and Joseph. But now this is yet another Jewish person in a much bigger empire, may I say, who has this incredible position of authority. As I said, what about this royal decree? So basically, it can't be repealed. So what they do is they organize a new edict to be sent out to allow the Jews. And of course, the king doesn't come up with this. Isn't that, Mordecai's involved in this. Mm-hmm. Let another edict be sent out to allow the Jews to gather together, defend themselves, and then to plunder those who attack them.
Yeah. So and self-defense, they can now defend themselves.
You're allowed to defend yourselves, right? And you've got plenty of warning because remember there's plenty of lead time. So this edict goes out and there's rejoicing throughout the empire. See, this is Purim. This is the celebratory sort of mode of the Feast of Purim. And so when the day of destruction comes, then the tables are
completely turned.
They actually have official help through Mordecai, so that they're able to prevail over those who attack. So quite likely they're even armed, you know, in this sense.
And interesting, just a very interesting aside here. It was basically 70 days from that decree to when that date place. And 70 is kind of the number of perfection or completion or whatever it might be. 70 years of exile, 70 days here.
It sounds a little bit in the text like that, you know, the Jews are going out and sort of slaughtering everyone they don't like. That's most probably what's happening here is that because of the widespread anti-Semitism, they are attacked, but they're ready for it, right?
Yep.
And perhaps other people aren't ready for the fact that they're ready for it.
Yeah.
And so they win this great victory.
Yeah. And in fact, a number of
people. In what is essentially a defensive battle.
A lot of people convert to become Jews.
Yeah.
Probably out of fear, really. They didn't want to have retribution. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting, though, there's a repeated statement made here, and this goes back to the story of Saul and Amalek.
Ah, yes.
Amalekites. Sorry, Saul and Agag.
Yep.
Because it says repeatedly in chapter 9, verse 10 and verse 15 and then verse 16, it says they did not lay their hands on the plunder.
Yeah.
Even though the edict said that they could. Now, why didn't they lay their hands on the plunder? Mm. Goes back to the edict that this is the law of Harem. So they're going to get right what Saul, Mordecai's forefather, got wrong.
Yeah.
Right? This is important moment here as well. And actually, Esther even requests another day for them to complete their destruction of their enemies
Susa, in the capital, because I think, you know, not so much in the other areas.
And Purim is established, as this festival to be observed in general with this great sort of military battle. Now, again, as we said before, very violent. And I think this is where, you know, there's a time for this when God's people are this limited sort of national identity. But, you know, what Christ does is he throws, you know, he wants to pull down the barriers and wants this to become, a people of all nations and places. So I think, you know, we would read this through, you know, the lens of the sort of change in that agenda, you know. So this is not justifying, essentially, this is not justifying this kind of violence. It has this place for this time to fulfill the promises of God in this way.
But Jesus actually fulfills those promises in full at his coming. Obviously.
That's right.
And so there's no need for that going forward. But at this time, this is where.
Yeah, that's right. At. Yeah. And that is an important point. But here is the, you know, and this is the remarkable thing about this book. I mean, never has there, even really since, has there been a time when the Jewish people were more under threat in this sense. Like, all the
whole
biggest,
world,
it's like pretty much the whole world, or, you know, this edict against it to wipe them all out. And yet there is this remarkable victory. God set things up with both Mordecai and Esther, you know, he's working behind the scenes. You know, it's like, for me reading this book, it's like whatever you're going through, it doesn't take God by surprise. God will be faithful. He will show his faithfulness, maybe not in ways that you want, but ways that serve his purpose. He is faithful. And at the right time and in the right way, God will show himself faithful to his people. And even if you think you're way away from where you should be, God's faithfulness stands.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.